Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
When is a president-elect more than a president in waiting? In extraordinary times like these. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. President Bush held one news conference on the economy this morning, and President-elect Barack Obama held another one just 2 hours later. The two teams have pledged close cooperation, but how difficult is it to address a crisis with one president leaving office and another one in the wings? Also tonight, Hollywood's upcoming awards season could be disrupted by another strike. This time, it's the actors. First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Today, we'll be talking about the ongoing economic challenges facing the country and the almost unprecedented political circumstances surrounding government responses to the crisis, as one president prepares to leave office and another gets ready to take over. What's at stake during this transition, and what lessons can be learned from history? First, this story. Despite the bleak economic outlook, the Screen Actors Guild has decided to ask its members to vote on a strike. This comes after weekend meetings failed to produce a deal between actors and the studios. The move could disrupt Hollywood's awards season for the second year in a row. My guest is Michael Spire, executive editor at Variety. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What's going on here?
Well, basically, SAG is the Screen Actors Guild is the union for actors, and they've been working without a contract while the hope is that they can get a deal for new media. I mean,
and this is without a contract since like June.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
For a couple of months, they've been working without a contract with the hopes that everybody would sit down, the major studios, and say, "Hey, everybody else has made a deal in town. Let's work it out. Let's make a deal that makes you happy." The problem is, over the weekend, they all met with a mediator, and the mediator couldn't make it work. And now SAG is saying, "You know what? We're going to ask our members for a strike because we're not happy."
Now, the issue, once again, is residuals for online work?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of nebulous. It's basically new media work. So it's digital work, online work, but that's the crux of it, yes.
Which was at the heart of the writer's strike.
Right, and that went on for, I think, 100 days, and it disrupted Hollywood, it disrupted productions, it disrupted the television season, the Academy Awards, all the award season, and it was a big problem. It was a big problem at the beginning of the economic crisis. You can only imagine what it's going to do if they stop working, if the actors stop working during the economic crisis.
Yeah, it's actually kind of hard to imagine it. It's almost sort of, what would the scale of that kind of a strike be in terms of the magnitude of its impact?
Well, I mean, first of all, the major studios are trying to use that as one of the bargaining chips, which is saying, how could you do this during the economic downturn that we've all faced? But I guess in the history of big business and strikes and Hollywood and non-Hollywood, you know, it's tough, and you got to strike when you think you're not getting a good deal. And if that's the case, that's why the Screen Actors Guild is saying, I know it's a tough time, but what do you want us to do, turn around and just take it? Basically saying, you know, we got to strike.
I mean, you could argue, if you were somebody speaking for the Screen Actors Guild, that perhaps, you know, no time is more ripe than a strike right now because the studios can't afford to be hurt.
That's exactly right, that a lot of people will say, look, times are tough, but now let's call their bluff and see what they're made of.
So how serious is the threat of a strike? Do you think it's just a showdown going on right now, or is there really a strike waiting in the wings?
Well, I would have said that if the writers didn't actually walk out and for 100 days there was complete disruption. And if they ask for a strike, I think a lot of members, the fact that they are SAG members, they're going to support their leadership. And that's, they're not going to get 100%, of course, but all they need is a 75% authorization. And that they very well could get that. In fact, they probably will get that. That's why they're members. They say, you're our leaders. We will trust you and do what you want. That said, there will be a lot of, you know, factions within SAG that say, I'm happy. Life's decent enough. We're not going to do this. And that's the big number you have to look for, 75%.
Because there are actors. I mean, notoriously, it's what, 95% of the Screen Actors Guild is never working.
Right, or very low working actors, exactly.
So they could have other jobs and not really care about a strike.
They could. And then there's going to be the big voices that are SAG members that go one way or the other. There's going to be the George Clooney levels of actors who say either get behind me, let's go for a strike, or guys, let's try to work this out. And it depends on who everyone's going to follow. That's the difference here, is that SAG is full of name people and marquee names and people that are recognized on the street, and people, that's a different rhythm and a different mojo than the writer's strike.
Right. There is a star power, obviously,
exactly.
That the average human being will recognize a George Clooney on the streets wanting to strike. Do you think that the actors will find a sympathetic public, though, at this period of time when everybody's hurting?
Probably not. I mean, the majors are usually the people who are sympathetic are the ones who are kind of within that faction. So you'll see the working actor will be sympathetic. The people that the average person on the Hollywood street who you come across and they say, you know, we need to do this for our future, you'll get those sympathetic comments. But Hollywood is notoriously looked upon as a town where everyone wants kind of the actors to shut up. I mean, they don't want them to be out there with political agendas, and they certainly don't think that they deserve anything more than the average working Joe. And so if the PR is against them, which it probably will be, because a lot of people look at the actor strike, they'll think it's just big names. And so, hey, these people make a lot of money, screw them. That's what the public sentiment probably will be. But you never know. But at the same time, the majors have a lot of PR guns behind them, and that you just don't want them to come out. They've already said that the actors are tone deaf. They put a PR statement right after the negotiations broke down over the weekend. They have a lot of guns behind them, and you kind of don't want to mess with that, and that's what happened with the writers as well.
Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael Spire is executive editor at Variety. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA. Just a few weeks ago, President-elect Barack Obama reminded the media there is only one president at a time. But with the building urgency of the economic issues facing the country, America's president-in-waiting is taking a more active role. Over the weekend, he called for a stimulus plan to create 2.5 million jobs. And this morning, he formally announced his administration's economic team. The outgoing and incoming administrations have pledged close cooperation. But how difficult is it to address a crisis while making a transition of power? My first guest is Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's co-author of the book One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Sarah.
Can you step back a bit for us and talk a little bit about this transition period, about what's involved in the transition from one Treasury secretary to another, from changes in policies that seem to focus on Wall Street to Main Street?
Sure. When you talk to the Obama to Obama's top advisors, you get the sense that they are definitely trying to pay attention to the lessons of history. You know, there's a sense that obviously in one parallel of 1932, the transition between Hoover and Roosevelt, that perhaps there should have been, in retrospect, more cooperation between those two.
That is the period in time that everybody refers to, coming out of the Great Depression.
And of course, Roosevelt was reluctant to be drawn into to Hoover's policies at the time and wanted to get a clean, fresh start. And there was some thought, obviously, in retrospect, that maybe that only sent the economy into further decline. So there's a sense of that part of history, but there's also a real desire by the Obama people and by President-elect Obama himself, presumably, to be able to only attach his own name to the problems once he has the formal power to do something about it. That is, once he can actually wield official power and sign into law this kind of stimulus package that he discussed over the weekend. So there are those competing desires going on, and it seems to be a bit of an awkward situation for them because, if you recall, 2.5 weeks ago, after he won the election, he and his aides immediately said there's one president at a time.
Yeah, that's words that have come back in dog years. I don't know, that's happened in, you know, in a nanosecond to change.
No, it's true, and we've seen in the last few days an evolution, a shift really, where Obama and his aides have decided they just can't afford to keep abiding by that hands-off strategy.
Well, so, now, is that in response to what's going on? You cover the White House. I mean, do they feel that the White House is just sort of kind of dying out in terms of addressing these policy initiatives or not doing the right thing? I mean, what's the dynamic that's happening at the White House that is causing this kind of response?
Well, there's a sense that the White House just doesn't have the clout. I spoke over the weekend with Leon Panetta, the former chief of staff to Bill Clinton, who has been in contact as an informal advisor to some of President-elect Obama's top aides. And he said that they're very aware of this awkward situation, but that there's a sense that the current president, the current administration, even if they wanted to do something big, they just simply wouldn't have the muscle or the juice to do it. And so he described it as being caught between a rock and a hard place, where you've got a current president who seems powerless to do anything, and the incoming president who's kind of in terms of constitutional power is powerless, but does have the bully pulpit and the ability to move opinion, but is reluctant to do so before he actually takes office.
I'm interested. President Bush's comments today came. He's in Latin America. Is there a feeling in your coverage and in reporting on the White House that the president is still actively engaged in trying to address these problems, or is he just bit by bit checking out of the situation or doing his best to make a transition work?
Well, I should say that I've been covering the transition and the Obama and the campaign, so
mm-hmm.
I don't have the inside knowledge right now of how the White House feels about this. I mean, I've looked at their statements in the briefing today, and I've looked at the president's statements, and I'm actually trying to figure that out today, because I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure the Obama transition team knows either, to be frank. I mean, I think that right now people are trying to figure out, you know, does the president, current president, have the clout and the muscle to be able to do anything? I think there's a sense that he doesn't. And so the question is, how do you, if you're Obama, how do you use the power that you have delicately? And so what we saw on Friday was the beginning of a new phase of the transition, where he's begun to send signals from the sidelines. They allowed the news to leak out of Geithner on Friday so that it would have an impact on the markets, and it did.
And the appointments that were announced today.
Yes, and the press conference today, that we really didn't learn any new facts today. It was really about atmospherics. I mean, the president-elect comes out with his economic team, and he makes statements, and he appears. It's all about creating a sense of confidence, because that's pretty much all he can do at this point. But whereas before he was essentially in seclusion, you know, this was the first press conference by the president-elect
since
2 days after he was elected. So before they said there's only one president at a time, and he was operating behind the scenes. We're going to now see him a lot. We saw him today in the press conference. He's probably going to be back tomorrow announcing more appointments. We're going to see him in the coming days. President-elect Obama will be moving more and more out into the limelight, and that's basically this new phase, that was, as it was described to me, a new phase in the transition where they've decided that he simply can't afford to sit back.
Peter Walston is covering the transitional team for the Los Angeles Times. Stay with us. I'm going to bring Paul Light into the conversation, professor of public service at New York University. He's the author of A Government Ill-Executed, The Decline of the Federal Service and How to Reverse It. Thanks for joining us. Paul Light, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am here.
Good. Glad we've got you. Thanks for waiting to join the conversation. Peter Walston made what I thought was a very interesting comment when he spoke of one president who is perceived as not having power because he's in the final days of his administration, and another president who truly does not have power yet because he's not in office. What can you tell us about this transition period of time and how it's being handled, or what to expect in what is sort of extraordinary circumstances?
Well, first let me say that I read Peter's writing faithfully.
Good. So, Peter's listening. Okay.
It's great stuff. So some of what I know is through his reporting, as well as some ongoing conversations. I think that Obama is being forced into this precisely because Bush is seen as not particularly relevant. His words of reassurance before the election were not taken very seriously, and his words of reassurance now are rather hollow. The markets definitely want to hear from Obama right now. And to the extent that Obama remains quiet, this crisis starts to become his in part. The market craves certainty. They want to know where he's headed. They want to know who he is picking, and he needs to get engaged. There's just no question about it. Otherwise, he's going to inherit a much deeper crisis on January 20th than he saw on November 4th.
It's been noted that Obama has made an extremely quick transition period in choosing his top advisors, and he's gone through a very, very strict sort of vetting process. But I'm curious about, is it going so quickly that there may be some mistakes in the vettings that are going on, or is sort of momentum on his side here?
Well, you know, ultimately, every president-elect makes a mistake, and I can guarantee you he will make one on an appointment of some kind. People are so ambitious to get into the new administration, any new administration, that they sometimes shade the truth. This 63-item questionnaire that the White House or that
the Obama team
is presenting is unbelievably detailed, but ultimately the vetting process depends on the applicants, the candidates' willingness to be forthcoming, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they may think that something that happened 20 or 30 years ago is not relevant any longer, but I can assure you that there's practically nothing that doesn't come out in the vetting process. The FBI eventually will talk to everybody they can regarding the individual's qualifications for office, their resume padding, and so forth. And this depends on absolute honesty, and inevitably somebody just doesn't quite come forth with all the information, and you'll get a bad appointment.
Just briefly, in this period of transition between governments, what sort of precedents would you look at for the ways that Obama is making his appointments and what's ahead for him?
Well, I just look back to the 1960s as we saw the number of positions that are up for appointment rise, the complexity of government increased, the number of people who work for government has remained roughly the same, but we have a huge contracting community now that delivers services on behalf of government. Contractors now, contract employees now outnumber federal civil servants by about 3-1. And in comparison back to 1960, this transition is off to a remarkable start. They did a lot of pre-election transition planning, and it's an A-plus plus at this given point. We don't know what's around the corner, of course, but they've done
A-plus plus at this point.
A-plus plus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Paul Light is professor of public service at New York University. Stay with us. William Luchtenberg is a professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is past president of the American Historical Association, and his book, Herbert Hoover, A Biography of the 31st President, will be published next month. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, and in such good company.
Oh, I'm so glad. Your biography of the 31st President is exactly the timely yet historical moment that we want to be looking at here, because that is the transition that is referred to as the only precedent that people are citing these days as Obama prepares to take power from Bush. In the transition between Herbert Hoover and FDR, obviously a sitting president was unseated, which is not like the current situation, but it was a transition during the worst economic crisis up to that time and between parties. What analogies can you draw for us in the current situation?
Well, the analogy to the Hoover-FDR transition is, as you say, becoming the common currency of all the discussion of the Obama transition. It ought to be quickly noted, though, that there are important differences. The transition, the interregnum between Hoover and FDR, was the last long interregnum in American history. It lasted not to January 20th, but to March 4th.
Why was that?
This had been established from the outset of the Republic. The 20th Amendment was making its way through the states and would be ratified over that winter, but it wouldn't take effect until 1937. So Hoover was the last lame duck in our history, and as you were saying, in the most terrible of all economic times.
And what lessons were learned in that transition. The amendment you referred to, of course, changed the inauguration date to January 20th, which it will be for Barack Obama. Were there lessons learned in that transition that you would be turning to today if you were a member of Obama's transition team?
Well, there is a sharp contrast to Obama's increasing involvement and what FDR did. What happened in November 1932 is that Hoover, having been badly defeated, the worst defeated Republican candidate in a two-candidate race in the history of the party, immediately set out to reverse the results of the election by compelling Franklin Roosevelt to endorse Hoover's program and give up on his own, as Hoover confessed to an old guard Republican senator from Pennsylvania. If Roosevelt does what I want him to do, he'll have to give up 90% of his so-called New Deal.
Which is a difference than today, where Bush has pledged to cooperate with Obama.
Exactly. Very different. And as a consequence of this, Franklin Roosevelt refused to be drawn in. At one point, Hoover in February sent him a handwritten 10-page letter in which, incidentally, he misspelled Roosevelt's name, an indication of how little regard he had for him, in which he set forth the theory that the country had been coming out of the Depression, thanks to Hoover's policies, and was now in a sense of crisis because Roosevelt had been reelected. Had been elected.
Yeah.
And there was a fear of FDR. And he expected Roosevelt to endorse that theory of the Depression. And understandably, Roosevelt refused to do it. He fibbed by saying that he had answered the letter right away, but it had miscarried. So he let the circumstance go right on almost to the eve of the inauguration. So sharply in contrast with Obama, Roosevelt was not involved with the outgoing administration and would issue no public statement, no preview of the policies that he planned to take up once he was inaugurated.
Interesting. Let's change tack for a moment. There have been a few voices calling for an early swearing in of Obama's administration because of the crisis, just saying that Bush should step down and Obama should be put in earlier. Is that possible?
No. In a word?
Would that be like the 21st Amendment that we'd have to be talking about in that case?
Yeah, you would. If all that would happen is if Bush were to step down, is that Cheney would take over the reins of government. And I doubt there are very many Americans who think that would be a good thing.
That's an interesting thought. We're going to go for our last comment to Peter Walston again, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Given the historical perspective, we've just been hearing from William Luchtenberg and Paul Light's comments. I'm wondering if you can just give us a look forward to the next, 60 days?
Well, like I said, what we're hearing from the Obama folks is that they're going to have President-elect Obama more vocal, more visible, trying to we haven't heard a word out of the Obama campaign about having his nominees take the reins before January 20th. You know, I think that was first proposed by Tom Friedman in the New York Times.
So, well, which we'll have to tell him it's not possible.
So that idea hasn't come from them, and the White House isn't entertaining that idea either. By the way, they said that this morning. So we're not going to see that. But what we will see is Obama more front and center, and he's going to use every opportunity to roll out these nominees very slowly. I mean, it's interesting if you think about it. The world already knows that Hillary Clinton is going to be Secretary of State. We're hearing some of the other national security nominees' names mentioned, but we haven't seen them announced yet.
There's been no formal announcement yet. We should note that.
And all of this is going to be about, you know, we may know the full team before it's officially announced, and all of these official announcements are going to be our orchestrated staged events where the atmospherics will be featured live on television, and they'll create images and pictures and more talking about the future. And it's all about creating confidence, giving people the sense that they shouldn't panic, that things will be okay starting on January 20th. That's what the Obama transition team is going to try to orchestrate now, is they're going to try to drip this out so that the next 60 days kind of passes without the bottom falling out, if they can help it.
Okay. Well, that it actually is 57 days and counting, I will note. That's all the time we've got today. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Peter Walston covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times. Paul Light is a professor of public service at New York University. And William Lochtenberg is professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Christian Bordahl, and Andrea Brody. The managing editor is Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.